Hello, welcome back to another Science Studio. I'm Russ Canelli, and the host, Keith Pannell, is traveling, so I'm alone today, and we have a very special guest today who's going to talk about surface science and nanomaterials. We're happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. David McElroy from the Department of Physics at the University of Idaho.
Thank you,
welcome,
Russ.
David, to
Thank
Science
you.
Studio.
Thank you.
So how did you get interested in science?
Being a child of the 60s and 70s, where both parents started working, there was no one to kind of keep me out of trouble after school. And I was fascinated with magnets. And so I was interested in how magnets become demagnetized when they're warmed up. And depending on how you cool them, they can stay magnetic or weakly magnetic, or they are no longer magnetic. So I just sit there and heat up magnets on the stove and then take them to the freezer and drop them in the ice or let them cool slowly and validate what I'd been taught. And so ever since then, I just always had an interest in just how things work. And that's why I went into physics.
So how old were you when you were playing around with these magnets?
I was in fifth grade.
Yeah. In fifth grade, they were actually teaching you about magnets?
A little bit.
That's something that's not quite common today.
Yeah, they would make sure that they had some science back in the day, and they did that. And I don't know if they did the greatest job, but at least they introduced the concept of a magnetic dipole, which, you know, these days you'd probably don't – the kids don't hear as much about. So they did – they got something into my head.
Do you remember when you were doing that, whether or not you realized that the Earth was also magnetic?
I knew there was a North Pole.
Because of Santa Claus?
Oh, what are you saying? There's no Santa Claus?
Okay.
Oh, thanks, Russ.
Yeah, so then you had this interest for a long time. So tell us how you got educated.
I went to the University of California, Santa Cruz, go banana slugs. I got to get that in and, got my bachelor's degree in physics. And then I went and worked as an engineer. That's one thing that a lot of, isn't really made clear to a lot of undergrads is that the training you get in the basic sciences can easily translate into doing, you know, an engineering type job. And I was working for about 3 years, and I realized that I knew exactly how all of the things we were doing worked and that if I did it for the rest of my life, I'd go crazy. So I decided I'd go to grad school. And I was, at the time, had an interest potentially in ocean acoustics. And at University of Rhode Island, they had a very good ocean acoustics person there. And I went there and thought I might want to do that. And then I met this young assistant professor who was working with all this really cool vacuum equipment. And the next thing I know, I was doing surface science.
So first, you got a BS in physics?
BA in physics.
BA in physics. And then you got a job as an engineer.
Correct. Mechanical project engineer.
What were you doing as a mechanical engineer?
I designed really large pieces of equipment for the semiconductor industry, like Intel. And then at one point, the touch screens we have on a lot of our devices, I used to design those as well. And then I did some quality control type stuff too.
And so there you were in engineering with a physics degree. And one of the things I think is interesting that people ask, in my own experience, okay, I had to make a choice between business, medical school, chemistry. And I remember the process, you know. I mean, I was interested in chemistry in the backyard since I was six. But, you know, how you make those decisions when you're young, I think is something very important for people to understand.
Well, it's interesting that you say you were interested in chemistry at six, because I actually did not tell the truth. My first physics experiment was when I was about 4 years old. And I realized that if I dropped my Tonka truck off of the balcony just right so that the wheels hit at the same time, it wouldn't flip over. It would just bounce straight up. And it bounced straight up and bent right in the middle. And I had that truck for years. But I knew I couldn't go into biology or medicine because I couldn't spell the words, let alone remember them. And so that kind of left things that didn't require a lot of memorization, and physics kind of fit the bill there.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit now. You decided you fell in love with surface science. Why?
Right. I love equipment. And surface science is one of those fields where you're studying phenomena, stuff that happens at the surface, like rust starts at the surface. So that would be a surface science type event. And I have a knack for equipment design, and everything is brightly shiny, at least when it's new, stainless steel with large vacuum vessels and all these toys. And I thought, wow, this is big science. This is cool. This is awesome. And I get to play with this stuff. And I realized I was getting to play with millions of dollars worth of equipment, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars. And to me, that's where it's at.
Well, we have to ask, did you ever break anything?
I break things all the time. And in fact, in my lab now, if my students and I aren't sure if what we've done will break something, I push the button.
I remember my experience when I first took some of my students here out to the synchrotron, and we were working in high vacuum line. And there was a warning there that if you didn't do something right, you didn't shut down your experiment, you shut down the whole thing. And there they were, you know, 10 o'clock at night, because they're running around the clock, and they made a mistake, and all of a sudden the alarms go off and the whole thing shuts down, and there was tears and hiding and so on.
I only had one grad student at the synchrotron vent a beamline, and the way I even knew it happened was I heard, and I said, "What was that?" And all the grad students looked at me like, "What?" And I went, "No, not what. We did something, and we vented not the whole synchrotron, but we did vent the beam line."
Okay, so surface science, actually, when you think about it, and I don't think anybody really thinks in this way, but everything in the room has a surface, and we're in an atmosphere with oxygen and so on and so forth. And so these surfaces all react to our environment.
Right.
One of the things I noticed out here in El Paso is the surface, the sun really works on the surfaces, you know, and you got to paint your house every 10 minutes. But tell us a little bit more about that, how the surfaces interact with the atmosphere.
Well, it's, in a nutshell, if you think about it, if you're deep down inside a material, all you see is your fellow atoms. So you're very happy. The world is understandable. Nothing's different. Everything's the same. And when you suddenly create a surface, life isn't the same. Those are the places where things have to adjust to the environment. And that adjustment usually means, for instance, an atomic bond will get softer. And because of that atomic bond getting softer, it's easier, for instance, for that atom to get popped off of the surface.
It's missing some of its neighbors and it's flopping around waiting for something to happen.
Exactly. And so you have electrons floating out there. And so everything we do, the surface is, I like to tell students that the surface is where all the action happens. Because whenever you have something change, that's where all the action happens. In x-rays, when you get your x-ray done, the reason your bone shows up is because the density of your bone is different than your flesh. And that's an interface, which is just a buried surface. And again, that's a place where all the action happens. And so the surfaces are where everything happens. Skin is essentially a surface material. And we have different dermic layers in order to achieve different things. But our toughest layers are directly on the very outside because of all the environmental constraints. Everything wear out. You have friction. Friction is a surface effect. If we didn't have friction, we wouldn't have things heating up and everything would be fine. And everybody's burned something in a pot or a pan. Well, that's always starts at the surface of the pan meeting the food. So it's all surface.
Yeah, so one could say that our entire existence is determined by surfaces, including our own skin.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, it reminds me, too, of some studies on cells where they have a certain membrane that allows a surface, allows yep. things in or not things in, and you know, it's very, very complicated.
The bacteria, the protein, whatever, comes down, and the first thing it has to do is contact that surface and then tell it, yes, let me in, and then the door opens. But
yeah,
if
right,
it can't
right.
do anything at the surface, I mean, Teflon is an amazing material because of its truly almost ultimately inert chemical
yeah.
properties. Because if you can't get through the surface, you can't get deeper down. So the surface is kind of the guardian of every material.
So when you were studying surface science, becoming a surface scientist, who were some of the stars that you thought about?
Stars as in the superstars of the field?
Yeah.
One of them, Franz Himsel. He was
Himsel, yeah.
He was a real incredible guy, very soft-spoken, really sharp, sharp guy. Did some amazing work at IBM. Another one was Dean Eastman, and he worked. I think he worked for Eastman Kodak. He wasn't related to the Eastmans, but he was Eastman Kodak, and he did some time also, I think, at General Electric. And he did some of the really early pioneering work in the field of surface science. And then the classic character slash great scientist is a fellow by the name of Jerry LePere, and he's up at Montana State University, and he's like the cowboy of surface science, and he did some really groundbreaking work in the 70s, 80s, and all the way into the 90s.
Yeah, so I remember the name Dean Eastman. What kind of surface studies was he doing?
He was doing a lot of work of looking on different types of single. So we call, when you form a single layer of an atom, we call that a monolayer.
Monolayer, yeah.
And so he was looking at different types of metals on monolayers of metals on different types of surfaces, because we were early on kind of the impetus for surface science was the catalytic converter process, or the catalytic process in our catalytic converters. And so a lot of the early work was just trying to understand why platinum was such a good surface for catalytic reactions. And so a lot of people, they early on started doing metals. And so he was looking at different things, gases absorbing on metals. So a lot of CO absorption on metals and things like that. So really, the work that he and his colleagues at that time did laid the foundation for all the stuff that we take for granted now in the scientific world that we just use as a tool. They developed all the fundamentals and all the concepts that we essentially have to utilize now.
You know, it's interesting you mention that now, because when I was working at Exxon, there was a gentleman there named John Sinfeld who eventually won a presidential medal for his work on catalysts. And the whole issue there was, and I remember it quite well because there was many people, was the automakers were blaming Exxon Fuel for the pollution. They said, make your fuel better. And Exxon was saying, no, 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 you have to put these catalytic converters in. And the story was that now every car, at least in the U.S., has the catalytic converter.
Oh, yeah. And that's and they're getting better. You know, in fact, catalytic converters are what are making our clean diesels better as well. They have they're a complex process now where they do the catalytic reaction, but then they have a I don't know if this is so much in the cars, but in the diesel trucks, they give a flash of fuel, and that flash of fuel burns up stuff and cleans off the catalyst so it can keep on running. And so they've really kind of, it's not only the engine performance, but it's the catalytic technology that's allowed us to start seeing these clean diesel cars on the run.
Okay, so when we talk about catalysts, we're talking about nanoparticles. I mean, the term nanoparticles was not used in the beginning with catalysts.
Because it didn't sound as cool as it does now.
Yeah. And so when you make nanoparticles, what you basically do is increase the ratio of solid to surface.
Yeah, it's essentially you're trying to get all of your atoms to be at the surface, as many as possible. And on top of it all, as we discussed, those atoms work differently. And so we get that out of them.
You're listening to Science Studio, where our guest is David McElroy, Department of Physics, University of Idaho, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you're active in social networking, you probably know about crowdsourcing. It's where startup companies or philanthropies use the internet to rally people and raise funds.
Now a biotech startup company called Ubiome is using the same concept to rally people to donate their microbiome. Someone actually wants my bacteria, Norbert.
Dave, we always knew you were special for something. We each have a unique inventory of microbial life that coexists on and within our bodies. In fact, we each have 10 times the bacteria over our own cells.
Scientists are just starting to learn the distinct types of bacteria and their roles in health and disease. For example, certain E. coli in our guts produce essential vitamins such as vitamin K. Changes in our microbiome are associated with autism, obesity, irritable bowel syndrome, and asthma.
We owe much of our recent understanding to the $170 million Human Microbiome Project. Scientists collected bacteria from 250 healthy people and sequenced their genomes. Now the information is freely available to all researchers.
The new startup company wants to sequence the microbiome of at least 1,000 people worldwide. You can participate. Find a link to the company on our website. They'll send you a kit to sample bacteria from your mouth, ears, and other body parts.
Once in the lab, samples are sequenced and the results are posted on their website anonymously. What's neat is the data can be available to citizen scientists to design and conduct their own experiments.
The benefits are obvious. Learning how the microbiome responds in health and disease can help us develop new diagnostics and therapeutics.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, where our guest is Professor David McElroy from the Department of Physics at the University of Idaho. And we're talking about surfaces and how they affect our lives and how they can clean our air. And so, David, tell us a little bit more about your research on nanoparticles and surfaces.
Well, most of, I would say I'm nano stuff, because nanoparticles are just one element of the nano world. And so what I do is I combine nanoparticles with these structures that are called nanosprings, which look like a telephone cord. For those of you that can remember what a telephone cord looks like, they're about that's what they look like, but there are only hundreds, thousands of atoms across. And so what we do is they have those nanosprings have a lot of surface. And so what we do is we actually put the nanoparticles onto the surface of these, because one of the things that happens is if you have a bunch of particles floating around, sitting there on a surface like dust in air or water, you blow and they're gone. So they need to be anchored somewhere. But a flat surface can't hold that many particles. Whereas with our nanosprings, we can hold a lot of particles. And on top of that, we can put different types of nanoparticles all on the same surface so that we can start to engineer their chemical properties and tune them. So really when people think of catalysts, that's just, let's say, two molecules coming together. They interact with a surface and off comes some new molecule. So we use catalysts in every aspect of our life. All of the medicine is a catalytic reaction. You know, chemicals, gasoline, all of these things. To make something, it really comes down to economics. You can make these interesting nanoparticles, but they have to have enough of them so that you can make enough of the product you're trying to make. So I work with, for instance, my colleague, Dr. Armando McDonald at the University of Idaho, and he's a chemist like yourself, but he does a lot of biomaterials and biofuels. And one of the things we're looking at is taking this material called syngas, which is hydrogen and CO2, and trying to convert it into kind of these higher alcohol or alkanes, as they're called. And what we've found is that our material, these nanosprings, has so much surface area that you can use a lot less of these metals. Because even though these metals are really good, we don't necessarily want these metals in the environment. And we can use a factor of almost 1,000, I think, less metal and still get a reasonable amount of product out. So one of the struggles, and so I'm going to get a little off topic on you, one of the struggles of nanomaterials is that they're kind of an environmental abomination and resource abomination. You use a lot, the typical process uses a lot of material to make a very small quantity of nanomaterials. In our process of our nano springs, for instance, we have an incredibly high efficiency. It costs practically nothing to make them. So and it's we use very inexpensive silicon-based molecules. So we're trying to come up with a new – this new material gives us a better opportunity to do essentially green chemistry, environmentally friendly chemistry.
Well, let's see. There's two questions I have for that.
Okay.
The first question is when you talk about a nano spring, see, I usually think of a catalyst as being a smaller and smaller sphere. And that's, of course, an approximation to many materials of different shapes. But the nanospring, what it's made out of?
It's made out of glass, silica, sand.
Okay.
And it...
So you're making a silica nanospring.
Right.
Which is basically, it's not just silica, it's SiO2, right? Or
right. So it's
like
silicon
that.
And oxygen,
yeah.
Which is glass, window glass.
Right.
And the technical term for its structure is it's amorphous. It's basically like Play-Doh.
Yeah.
Instead of having a nice, you know, fired ceramic, you have Play-Doh.
Okay, and what metals do you put on it for the CO hydrogen, for example?
We were doing what's called a Fischer-Tropsch process. So we've been using iron, cobalt. We're trying to stay away from the dreaded ruthenium because it's as expensive as platinum. And it's a very simple process. We grow the nanosprings onto a surface, and then we just use a solvent with some of these metal ACAC, metal ACACs. Folks, I don't know what a metal ACAC is either. My students just tell me what it is. And we just reduce it in hydrogen, and then the nanoparticles form bonded to the surface of the nanosprings.
How do you make the springs?
Russ, I'd have to kill you if I told you.
Yeah,
that.
Well, I was going to ask you about patents and
yeah.
You know that
it's patent pending. I call the machine that we use, it's an atmospheric process, which differs from most types of processes to grow nanowires and things like that. It's atmospheric. We run it at about 350 to 400 degrees C, so it's like a very hot oven. Flow gases at atmospheric pressure, which is, you know, the pressure in our room. And we use our secret chemical. It's actually a very, very complex process that we stumbled upon. And it only takes about 30 minutes and boom, we have it. It's scalable. We integrate our nanosprings into different types of microelectronic sensors, devices of all sorts. It's a really, really versatile material. And what we do is we allow it to do all the different things by putting different coatings on it. So for catalysis or Fischer-Trops, we might put the metal particles on it. But for instance, when we make sensors, gas sensors, we grow a layer of zinc oxide on it because rather than trying to develop a completely new process for making nanosprings, if they're silica nanosprings coated with zinc oxide nanosprings, they're zinc oxide nanosprings.
So you can make nanosprings out of what? Any oxide?
You theoretically, yes. We first discovered nanosprings in about 1998. And they were made out of this material called boron carbide. And we developed a theory to explain how they form this helical structure. And it turns out that essentially you have to have an amorphous material in order to get springs. Otherwise, it wants to grow straight like a wire. So if it's a crystal, like a diamond or something, it would grow straight. It wouldn't curve. And we published the paper only – so we made the discovery in 1998 – and then in about 2001, I think we published the paper. And the reason it sat so long is we didn't know why the springs formed. And finally, when I developed the model to explain how the springs formed, we concluded that paper by pointing out that if all the conditions were met that we saw with boron carbide, you could make other nanosprings. Well, we eventually made silicon carbide nanosprings, again, the same things. And eventually, I was able to get, if anybody's familiar with the Keck Foundation, they make the telescopes on Hawaii and all that, or pay to have them made. They gave me about $900,000 to go crazy trying to make nanosprings. So in a typical sample, one sample every 4 months had nanosprings. And then within that sample, maybe a quarter of a percent, so a quarter of a percent were springs. All the rest were straight wires. So I proposed to the Keck Foundation that maybe I could make a sample have 50% nanosprings and 50% straight wires. Well, we make 100% nanosprings every time.
Another thing that's interesting to me about it, I thought you said you were a physicist. You sound like a material scientist like me.
I do everything. Material science is the crossroads of all the disciplines, and we all cross over into material science. You know, what I like to tell students is that when you get to the higher levels that we operate at, engineers, chemists, physicists, a lot of us are doing a lot of the same things. We just bring a different approach to it, or we get pulled into a problem because of what our expertise is stronger in one area than theirs. So it's kind of material science is the melting pot of all of us.
So if we think about silicon and oxygen and, you know, amorphous material, which means there's no crystal structure and so on, what's the difference between a spring and a straight wire?
The spring, not much on a mechanical standpoint. If you said, oh, does it spring like? Yeah, it'll spring like.
No, but on the atomic level, why is one, curling and the other one straight?
Well, I would have to give you a whole one-hour presentation on that, which I – and with pretty pictures. And since we're on radio, Russ, I don't think that's going to work. Essentially, what it comes down to is that by not having crystal structure, it doesn't care what direction it grows. And so at the tip of every one of these nanosprings is a little metal droplet, which is called the catalyst in this case, because it helps absorb material from the vapor. So that's the atmosphere around the gold particle. In our case, we use gold for the nanosprings. The gold is melted. It absorbs some of the silicon from the atmosphere around it. And when it gets totally saturated, it starts to push that silicon out. Well, that means there's that droplet can move around and wobble around. When you have the right circumstances occurring, that wobble can get locked in. And once that wobble gets locked in, it just grows in a spiral. So it's kind of an instability at the tip of the nanowire that's forming. So the nanowire grows at the tip. So the growth where it's growing is not at the surface that it started at. It's at the droplet at the top. So the little gold particle actually gets lifted off of the surface and out into proverbial space.
Oh, I see. So this is something where you're saying the pictures are very inspiring. So the gold particle is the catalyst.
Correct.
And if it's small enough, I guess it wobbles, and that's what induces the spring-like character.
Correct. And so we modeled that. That was in our paper in 2001. And the silicon nanosprings, it's the same sort of concept, but it's a little bit different because they're actually a little more complicated. In the early work, each nanospring consisted of one nanowire coiling. In these nanosprings, they're comprised of 5 to 8 nanowires coherently coiling. So there's a little difference there, but the general idea is the same.
Well, it's very, very nice that you've been here, and the conversation could go on forever. And so we're very happy that Professor David McElroy from the Department of Physics at the University of Idaho has been here on Science Studio. Please come back. Thanks, David, for being on Science Studio.
Thanks, Russ.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.